When you've got that time, make use of it. Don't just think of it as a wasted time, not earning any money to pay off your degree or whatever you have to pay off. Just think of it as time to be able to look into yourself and work out either what you want to do in your future.
Hello, welcome to the 9th episode of the Dental Head Start podcast. This week we've got a dentistry Facebook icon, someone you'll certainly know, Dr. Omar Ikram. He's well known for being so generous with his knowledge and sharing through Facebook, essentially a Facebook blog where I think we've all learned something from if we follow his page. So of course, someone sharing so much for graduates, students and dentists in general, it was a natural progression to get him on the podcast. In this chat, we hear a bunch about his early years, how he ended up becoming an endodontist and what made him interested in the field. And then we chat about some specifics, including where he sees graduates making mistakes. He gives some tips on restoring root-treated teeth, some tips on finding MB2, which we all have troubles with early on. And he gives his thoughts on how to manage the patient that you've treated, you've seen for an appointment or two, and you still then have to refer them off to a specialist. Most graduates struggle with endo. I know it's something that makes me a little bit nervous when I see it on my book, and Omar really helps clear up a lot of this confusion through this discussion and definitely on his social media content that he shares. So definitely check that stuff out if you haven't already. And thank you for listening to the podcast. It's been great hearing from you guys and hearing the things you've resonated with and what's helped. Feel free to reach out and give us feedback on Facebook, on Instagram, or at david@dentalheadstart.com via email. That's enough from me. Here's Dr. Omar Ikram. So Dr. Omar Ikram, welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast.
Thanks, David, for inviting me. It's a big honor to be able to speak to you guys.
Well, it's great to have you back on. We had you, we interviewed you on a blog a couple of months ago and got a bit of this information already, but I'd love to dive a bit deeper on some of, you know, what you've done and what you're doing for the dental community, particularly for graduates. And I wanted to start by saying thank you for what you do. And I'm sure most or all the listeners would know who you are and would appreciate what you do. So thank you for spending the time to share all that information with us.
No, that's not a problem at all. It's just stuff that when I was going through dental school and when I graduated, we had these long sessions, funnily enough, over lunch when I used to work in the UK, because I worked in New Zealand for a bit, as you probably know, but it was a small practice. And then I moved to the UK in this massive practice where we had about 9 or 10 dentists working. And we used to have these discussions at lunchtime about endodontics. Why does it work? Why doesn't it work? Is it something? How can we predict our endodontics? And basically, all these questions came up during lunch break, which was kind of funny because lunch breaks the sort of time you hope to be away from the dentistry and thinking about other things. But actually, it's probably the time that it consumes you most when you're sitting there quietly thinking, "Wonder what's going on in that case or whatever." And people used to talk about the stuff, and a lot of the dentists that I used to sit around with have been qualified for, you know, at that stage, 25, 30 years or around that sort of time. And these people also had difficulties understanding the concepts that we were discussing. They weren't sort of as knowledgeable as we thought they might be after that many years. And that really got me thinking towards, if we could do this and if we could work out some kind of answer for these questions, which actually aren't too difficult to answer but were a mystery to me at the time, or at least we can have theories about the answer and not necessarily the exact answer, then we can perhaps help other people. And this is where I guess the early ideas about creation of a Facebook page came to me. But of course at that time I didn't really, there was no such thing as Facebook or social media, and I didn't really even feature as an area of interest. But I guess down the track I started thinking about this, and also just generally talking while I was training in specialist training, again, the same sort of things would come up and we'd talk about them and we'd debate them. And eventually this came to fruition because of social media, and I guess it just went from there.
Yeah, it's something that with social media, us younger dentists, I think, have a lot more access to current information, more access to specialists like yourself. And I think that lifts our understanding, and I think that lifts the patient care we can provide. So I think it's just a really great thing. Obviously, I do, because that's why I started to try to help new graduates myself. How do you find the time to do all that you do?
That's a good question as well, because a lot of people ask me this. Originally, when I started doing this, Facebook and social media was around January 2012, and I didn't have any children at that stage. And you know, I did have a bit more free time on my hands, so I used to post probably at the end of a day of work where I hadn't seen too many patients, and I was still had a bit of enthusiasm for the day, and that was fairly easy. And then as I started working more, it became more difficult. But what I found was, like, with the commutes to work and stuff, and also I traveled to Tamworth on the plane, and I still do this where I travel and I would write stuff down. I once read a book on Beethoven, and he used to keep notes and ideas about musical themes and then come back to them, and they would feature in later works. And I thought to myself, well, it's good to have a note. We now have these phones, obviously, we can stick all these notes in. And my phone's full of notes about thoughts, processes, or ideas that maybe I just come up with one morning and think that's a great topic, and then I'll just go back to it later. So a lot of the stuff that you read on social media has actually been written maybe 1 to 2 days before, or maybe even a week before I started writing it, and I've changed it, modified it, and then it's come out. So I suppose I find time when I have time, and I just write little concepts down, and then sometimes these things fizzle and I can't be bothered with that idea or that thought process, and I don't write any more. Other times I go back to it and I think I'm not really in the mood to write about the subject because it's just not something that I'm really passionate about at the moment, and I just shelve the idea. But other times you pick up an idea and you run with it, and then that's what becomes one of the posts, I guess.
It's funny, you're talking pretty much exactly the way I do things as well. I have a phone full of notes, and everything that's pretty much written, bits and pieces here and there when I've got a few minutes. I also started what I'm doing before I had children. So it's the same concept of having a family makes things a bit more difficult.
Yeah, and I find that now my having a bit of an older family, they're a little bit older, and they're more into the sort of things that I'm into. It really draws you away from doing this stuff. But we can always find time. And also I find that there's an intermeshing between what I teach my children and what I'm trying to teach new dentists. And quite often the message is pretty similar, although obviously they're much younger and they have longer to go in their lives and careers and all these sort of things. But with a new dentist that comes out, it's the same base concepts of trying to make the most of what you have. And if you have one of the favorite things that I talk about with new graduates is you might think that some of the things in your life are a disadvantage, like you haven't got enough patients to see. Oh, wow. I thought that I was going to be really busy when I graduated, even though I'm working now rurally or something like this, and it's just not happening as quickly as I wanted to. And I said, well, make the time. When you've got that time, make use of it. Don't just think of it as a wasted time, not earning any money to pay off your degree or whatever you have to pay off. Just think of it as time to be able to look into yourself and work out either what you want to do in your future, what you want to do outside of dentistry, or maybe just where you're going to go this year with your dentistry. It's a really good time, and that's sort of where the Facebook page started, because I had a bit more free time. I'd opened a business in Crow's Nest, and I wasn't seeing 6 or 7 patients a day. I was seeing 2 or 3, and that was kind of, and you look back on that time and actually think that was actually quite fun. It's funny how it all comes around full circle. When you get a bit more commitment and busy in your life, then you lose the ability to do these things, and all that sudden that spare time seems like it was really fun, even though you might not have thought it was fun at the time.
That's right. You've got to use what you've got, and if you've got the time, that means you've got time to do CPD, whether it's online or however else. And I think that's pretty important. When you get really busy and you have no time to do online CPD, it cuts into your personal time. And then so that's a negative as well. So there's positives on both sides.
Some of the new graduates I see, they think that they want to have so many personal commitments in their life, and then some have more and some have less, obviously, when they graduate. Some people are getting married and some people are not getting married and all these sort of things. But you know what? If you can use the time that you have efficiently to progress somewhere, I've seen And there's some really great examples of people that I know where they, you know, things didn't go to plan in their life necessarily as they graduated or in their first couple of years of dentistry. And they've turned it all around and used that time so effectively. And I think to myself, wow, hats off to you for like doing so well in a point of adversity, or what some people would see as adversity. And you've turned it around, you've got something out of that time, and then maybe they've moved on with their life after that and everything's gone back to a more regular routine life.
Yeah, I'm a big believer of that, and using the time you've got, but planning as well, and then small little steps add up to really big changes.
Yes, exactly.
So let's start from the beginning. We know we've done an interview with you before in a blog on the Dental Head Start website, but so we know where you grew up and all those bits and pieces. But just run us through your childhood, and you grew up in New Zealand. How did you decide to do dentistry?
Well, it was actually quite an interesting story. I was in Christchurch, New Zealand, and we can apply. And in those days in New Zealand, we were able to do a year at university and then just apply for any medical, dental, pharmacy degree. You could just tick a box. And I applied for dentistry and I got in. And the interesting thing was when I applied, you just tick a box, and it was literally before you got your exam results. And I don't think you had even sat the exams yet, or maybe you just sat them. You hadn't got your results yet. And I was actually getting ready. I ticked the boxes, et cetera, and I went into my biology head of the department at Canterbury University, and I said, actually, so when I got my marks, I said, I've got these marks. I've applied for dentistry. I don't know if I've got in or not yet. And he looked at my marks and he said, you probably haven't got into dentistry. Your marks aren't quite good enough. So I suggest you do some zoology course, dissecting dogfish or something like this, and, you know, perhaps try again. And actually what was happened was I felt really bad, obviously, about that discussion, and he'd sort of run down the marks. I didn't do too badly, but I didn't do like A+ in every subject. But I'd done okay, considering my mark the mid-year. I'd actually pulled myself up quite a lot by the end of the year. And then I got a letter like a week later, I think it was Christmas Eve, from Otago University saying, you're on the waiting list for dentistry. So I'd gone to this meeting with my head of biology, who told me I essentially hadn't got into dentistry, and there was a letter on Christmas Eve saying you might have got in, but you're on a waiting list. So in other words, the response to the tick or the box that I'd made earlier, and I got excited about dentistry all of a sudden and thought this is going to lead somewhere. And although I did like sciences, I couldn't see that doing a zoology degree was going to lead me to a profession, which my parents had thrashed at me since I was a young child, that you must do a profession, both being medical doctors. They thrashed that, but shoved that down my throat. So I just thought, if there's going to be something to do, then it probably would be good to do dentistry. And you know what? If I want to do something else after dentistry, there's no reason why I couldn't do other health science related subjects or maybe other things. You know, dentistry leads on to a lot of things, not just drilling teeth. Obviously, many of us do this, but there's lots of things you can do in dentistry outside of just being a dentist. So then I thought, got excited, and then sure enough, about 2 weeks later, I got the message, or maybe it was a month later, saying, you're into dental school. Please, you know, apply for the course and start the orientation registration process.
It's quite an exciting time when you get that information that your whole life's going to change. It really does make a difference. Do you remember when you then decided to get into to specialize?
Yeah, this was an interesting. This was even more unusual because after I'd done my dental degree, throughout the course, I'd always kind of thought endodontics was a good specialty or an interest of mine. I wasn't terribly good at endodontics. Most of us as students aren't terribly able at endodontics. I remember thinking to myself, how do you physically do this job? Like, how does anyone do this? Trying to laterally condense and put a spreader in and thread it through and, you know, back through the path, and just thinking, this is really difficult. Like, what's happening here? And what happened was I did it a lot in my first year because we used to get a lot of patients, as you do when you first graduate, you get all those emergency patients. And the options usually are you've left the, you know, carious tooth too long. You can either have the tooth extracted or you can have a a root canal treatment, and you did get patients who didn't want to lose their tooth, so you ended up doing a bit of root canal treatment. Not much crown and bridge because they were the pain was gone, they disappeared and never wanted to see a dentist again. But they did get their root canal treatments treated. So I did get to do quite a lot in my first year. Out of all the, you know, I guess procedural parts of dentistry in my first year, endodontics probably was the most common or one of the most common ones. Crown and bridge was quite low. So I did get a bit of interest in it during my first year and thought maybe it's a good thing to do, and that stayed in my head. But when I went to England and working on the National Health with the huge volume of patients and the trickiness of doing root canal treatments efficiently, I did lose a lot of motivation because of the volume of work we were subjected to and the you know, just a huge amount of patients and lots of emergency cases, and it was just difficult to do things. You know, you're trying to extirpate quickly and get people out of pain, and it's just really, really overwhelming. And, you know, I was seeing something like, I think after the first 6 months, I was seeing 19 patients a day. And if you happen to see an emergency patient, but like some of those things that I learned in that early stage, although I sort of say it was really difficult, were actually really character forming and also set the standard of where I, set the kind of goal to which I aspire to now with regards to the way I treat my patients and practice in Crow's Nest. You know, if there is an emergency patient that comes back, we see them on the day. Like, there's no see you in like 2 weeks because I haven't got a space. I see them on the day. I get patients from all over Sydney come to the practice. We have slots every day for emergencies. So I carried this on, this idea of like, we provide a service for our patients. If the patient needs to come in and it's important and they're in pain, you have to see them on the day. Like, that was the way we worked in London. We managed to put people in at all times. We didn't often see them right when they walked in the door, but we'd always see them at the end of the day or something like that. And again, the staff at my practice in Crow's Nest are amazing at accommodating this, because of course, if they just want to leave and leave me, I wouldn't be able to do the treatment for the patients. So this is something I've carried through. So you pick up these little things in your career when you think, oh, it's overwhelming and stressful. You actually pick up these things that, oh, this is quite a good way of working. It's tough, but it's a good way to make sure that patients can get treatment and access to your care.
It's interesting in the formative years that we work in these practices, and they give us there's good and there's bad, and our experience first, our first job, it really does shape us. But even if it's a job that's been tough and maybe you've moved on from, I think we all pick something up. I think that's a really good thing to note, that now you know, treating emergency patients on the day and really caring for your patients.
Yeah, that's right. So I learned this very early on, but at the time I was learning, it wasn't very pleasant to learn all this stuff. But later on you think, well, that helped people. And, you know, I do get patients come to me and they say they love the dentist because he sees them on the day and tries hard for them. So it does have an effect on patients. But the real reason I got into specialist training was quite interesting. It was, so I'd gone through this sort of tough time doing endo and like thinking, I don't really know if I like endo anymore. It's very demoralizing. You have to see patients all over the place and all over your day in emergencies. And, you know, you get flare-ups and all that sort of stuff. And what happened was one evening I was sitting in the staff room, and one of my friends was talking to this dentist that I was friends with. He was a DJ and a dentist. And my friend, as he got up to leave the room, my friends turned to each other and said, he's really good at endo. If you want to learn endo, go and look at this guy's stuff. And I thought, how can anyone be good at endo? We have all these patients and we have to do things quickly and efficiently. And it's like, you know, it's just a procedure. We have hand filing. We have no microscopes. And how doesn't he, you know, have these difficult challenges that everyone has? And so after about a day or two, I went to my friend who was, as I said, he was a dentist. He was an older dentist, a postgraduate. He'd done a postgraduate degree beforehand, and he was a bit more life experienced than me. And he used to say to me, Omar, it's all about taking your time and making sure that they have the best treatment you can do. And if you can take your time, you will get better at endo and you will start to make small steps towards doing the kind of work that you want to do. And
that must have been a very hard thing to do in the NIH.
It was very hard because the way that I mean, it was good. I mean, like, look at it this way: we got to see huge amounts of patients, but obviously, time was a factor, and basically, being able to do the treatment well in the time that you had was the challenge. And look, our practice was great, and the boss was very understanding about these things. And look, that's one thing. Again, another thing I learned was, like, treat your associates well. I mean, they are learning, and they will make errors early on. They will, you know, annoy patients. But look at this way: if they're there and they stay, they will be very loyal. And this person that I worked with in London, he was a fair boss, but he was a tough boss. He always used to look after his dentists when the, you know, push came to shove. So, and you know, if he took an extra 15, 20 minutes or half an hour about a root canal treatment, he didn't bat an eyelid, and that's great, because a lot of bosses, they have put their associates under pressure, and that's no good for learning then. So I was very fortunate to have him as my boss in some ways, and so I used to take my time, and then it would lead on to other things, like more crown and bridge. You could do the root canal treatment and the crown and bridge, and then all of a sudden you were doing more crown and bridge work, which is what I like doing as well. And I was getting referrals from the other 10 dentists within the practice. You know, can you just take out this little piece of gutta percha in the, you know, one cone, and then do the retreatment? And it's like, sure. So I just started to expand my portfolio of cases, or my repertoire, and just pick and choose. You know, that's how I'm, you know, some cases I'd say, no, this is not a case I could treat, but some cases would be a case. It just got more and more complicated post-removal. So I was doing all this before I specialized, and then eventually I was getting patients referred from the boss, and they were like private dental cases then from him, and that started the whole process. And then I got to a stage where I really thought to myself, well, I've got all this experience and interest in endo, and I quite like it, and I'm, you know, he was getting me enough files, and we were using ProTaper Universal in those days, and literally I had all the equipment. I bought some of my own stuff, and I thought, this is really good, but I have to make an advantage out of this. I have to get some recognition that I've done this work. It's no point me doing this work and then going off and starting my own practice and then changing the way I work. I want to push on from here. So I applied for the master's at King's College. After that, and then I got accepted in my first year, which I was very fortunate to be accepted that year.
So did you continue working throughout your study at King's?
Yeah, so at King's College, it's a four-year degree. It's got an MRD component, which is a membership of restorative dentistry, like a kind of – it's like a fellowship, like a membership part, and it has a university qualification, which is the Masters of Clinical Dentistry, which is the one I've got from London University, University of London. So what happens there is the college, the Royal College, follows you through your training, and they're the ones who give you the certificate of a specialist training, and then you become a specialist. So that's how it works in the UK. But you can do a part-time degree, but it's 4 years. So it's the same hours as a three-year full-time degree. But I think the 4 years is quite good in some ways. First of all, you get to work, although it's quite stressful when you're working and trying to cover all the university costs and living in London. It did give you, you know, an extra year of case reports to be able to call on when you did your exams, because it's 4 years of healing versus 3 years of healing. Of course, in your first year, most of the cases you do, you're learning to use the equipment, and you're just getting into, like, microscope dentistry, and you don't really use the first year's cases to present at the end of the time, but you can use the second year. But, you know, when you're doing a three-year degree, you really need to have, by the end of that first year, you need to have, like, at least probably half the presentation cases, because they got 2 years to heal, and some of them won't turn up, don't come back. Some of them won't heal. Some of them, you know, don't go to plan. So if you're doing a three-year degree full-time, you really, by the end of your first year, probably have to have at least half the cases you're going to present. And that's quite hard when you're new to microscopes and everything that we learn in specialist practice and the training.
So did you enjoy the actual training side of being becoming a specialist, or was it quite stressful? Like, how did you find all that?
Well, that was quite interesting, because I've spoken to many postgrads in Australia, and they say the same thing. They pretty much say that the course was okay. Like it was, you know, I think a lot of people who haven't done specialist training, they think somebody's going to talk to you about how to find MB2, start showing you, and then you can do it next time. And that doesn't really happen when you do specialist training. Yeah. It's all about self-criticism. It's all about learning in an environment where you do have colleagues to talk to, but it's not like they're showing you with their hands to do something. It's not undergraduate dentistry where there's more hands-on stuff, like there's more hands-on practice stuff before you get on patients. You start and you work with the stuff that people show you and tell you about, and then you go from there. And it's, I guess, as dentists, we are supposed to be fairly isolated, and as a job, we're not. Most places don't have many dentists working in the same practice under the one roof, or at least, you know, at the same time. And we do have to be self-critical and learn from our errors or things that went well or not well. But it's like I really found the specialist training was quite. I really enjoyed the academic side of things, the discussions or the papers that we would look into, the classic articles. I enjoyed that immensely. And Philip Mitchell, who did these tutorials with us, was a really good teacher. Shannon Patel also was good. He taught me a lot. So the practical side, it wasn't so much fun at the start. It was very hard because you've got, you know, this tooth is going to be lost if you don't save this tooth. Can you imagine the transition from a general practitioner, which can refer to, like, I'm the referral in about 1 month. The transition is quite immense. So in the first year, I found that quite stressful, but the academic side of thing I really enjoyed. By the time you get to the research and you realize that research is super hard, mm-hmm. and if you ever criticize a paper, you'll never criticize a paper again after you've done your own research, because you'll realize how difficult, you know, even these papers that you think are like don't look like they've done much, well, they've done a lot. I did enjoy the process to some degree, and at the end of it, every postgrad tells me the same story. No matter how far ahead you are, no matter how well you're doing in your course, you will always be made to feel like it was stressful. It's just some sort of rite of passage or initiation into the endo club or something like that. But it's just, I remember mine vividly. I think I had like a 6 month head start on everyone because I started my research early, and I think I submitted the research with a day to go or something like that before the deadline. So literally it was like, you know, like it wasn't coasting at all.
No. So hard work, but worth it, I can imagine.
Well, yeah, it's hard work, but it's worth it. And despite what a lot of people say, just diversify your career as a dentist, being a specialist.
Yeah, it gives you, I guess, being able to focus. I think you raise a really good point about assessing your own work as well, and something that you're forced to do in specialist practice to become the best. And I think that's something that's easy for graduates and any dentist, in particularly in general, to not do. And I think that's a big that can be a big failure. So that's a really good point. Something I'm working on myself. So how was the first couple of years after graduation, like post-graduation, and being a specialist and setting yourself up?
Well, that's another funny story. So I worked for about after graduation, in just under a year, I was in London, and I decided to move to Sydney with my wife, and I stumbled on this ad in ADA, I think it was the ADA website. And it said, specialist practice in Crow's Nest needs a receptionist. And I remember, you know, I was new to the area in North Shore, and I thought, well, I wonder if they have an endodontist. And I contacted the practice, and the practice manager forwarded this on to the owner of the practice, Philippa Sawyer, and she had established a specialist pediatric practice with general dentists and basically other specialists, but they didn't have an endodontist.
Yeah.
And she just said to me, you can start your own business, just rent the room one day a week. I've got a microscope, you can use that too, and get a logo, get an ABN, and let's get started. And you can do it in, like, how long will it take you? Well, probably take me like 2 months, because I had a lot of my own equipment with me. I used to travel in the UK and stuff like that. I had a few of the things that I used to use. So I didn't have to buy all the equipment, but I did have to buy some of it. So I sort of bought what I could and, you know, various files and stuff I had to get, and basically ended up setting up in Crow's Nest, and have been there ever since. So that was the story of how I got into Crow's Nest. And also at that time I was working in the dental hospital. I'd got the position there doing 3 days a week. So it's kind of a nice mix. And then soon after that, Philippa then started a practice in Tamworth. And I used to go and travel to Tamworth once per month and see three or four patients there for root canal treatments. And then I used to go back to Crow's Nest and then mix that with the hospital. So it was funny. It was a bit of a mix of things. So you won't expect you don't often expect these things to turn out like this, but actually it was kind of fun in some ways. You know, you have these memories of traveling and Tamworth and patients, and you know, the rural patients are really nice and stuff. So it was really interesting. But now I'm just obviously in Crow's Nest in the dental hospital as well.
Mm. It's an interesting point how with the variety in your work early on, it can be quite a good thing. I work in three different practices in pretty different areas, and I actually really quite like the variety. It allows me to learn more, to be honest.
Well, that allows you to learn more, allows you to treat different patients from different backgrounds and professions and socioeconomic statuses. It allows you to look at the running of the practice, which I found very good. Like the way that practices run, I remember working for this dentist, as I mentioned, in London, and the way he ran his massive practice and the way that was versus, say, my friend who ran a boutique private practice in Wandsworth were vastly different, but you know, effective as well. Like so different, but effective. And I remember my friend of mine in Wandsworth. He was running a he had a patient come in, and he was running late for the day. And he came out, and the patient was one of these patients asking 100 questions. And I remember him sitting there and answering every single one of this patient's questions, like the sort of so off the wall stuff the patient was talking about. And I thought, this is what you need to do when you're in your own practice and you've got patients that are coming in, you're looking to build up, and you know, hats off for him to sitting there and answering like all these questions that were fired at him at the end of a long day. And I just thought, this is a very interesting, different way of working compared to the bigger practices that I'd worked at.
Yeah, there's definitely different philosophies on that. And I think depending on where you are, I guess, treating your patient really well is by far the best kind of marketing you're ever going to get. They're going to tell someone else. So if you've got the time to really give them a good experience, and hopefully you do when you're in your earlier years, it makes a massive difference. It's what makes you busy. That's a really good point.
Yeah, sometimes people just need a friendly ear. You know, they're the sort of person that, well, if they ask 100 questions and they've been ignored by other dentists, and all they want to do is you to sit there and lend a friendly ear to their concerns. And it's quite unbelievable how many patients obviously do get sort of passed on or whatever, because they're kind of that annoying patient. But actually it's good to sometimes just lend an ear and just listen to their concerns, and often that will be enough to help them and make them give a positive experience.
It's a real pleasure when you do have those patients that they might come in and they're really anxious, or they're in some way, I guess, different, and you can turn them around just by treating them well and listening to what they have to say. And another dentist might think they're a problem patient, but they're in fact just wanting to be heard. I've experienced that in my early years for sure.
We have a friend of mine the other day. The patient came to see me, and the patient was all smiley and happy. And she said, "I've just been to see your friend for some, I think it was a call build up or something." And I said, "Oh, what was so nice about her practice?" And she said, "She had a dog which sat on my chest." So that was a big positive for this patient. So, you know, you don't know what's going to make the patient feel happy. It's quite unusual, but obviously it worked.
I've heard a bit about that recently of dogs used for anxiety control, and it's quite an interesting concept. Clearly it works. I wanted to get back to something about specialization. So in your early years, obviously becoming a specialist and then getting set up is fairly difficult, I would imagine. But my thoughts around this is general dentists at the moment are definitely trying to push their boundaries in what they do. So certain disciplines, PROS comes to mind, where dentists are doing a lot more of the work that in the past would have been referred off. Is that something you think about? And I think endo might be fairly fortified, as with some others, but what do you think about the future of specialisation in the dental field?
Well, I think, to be honest, that dentistry as a career is changing so much, even since I graduated, even as a specialist, has changed in the last 8 to 10 years in Sydney. I imagine it's similar elsewhere in Australia. And the future of specialisation is not back when, you know, back a long time ago, when I arrived in Sydney, well, 8-9 years ago, when I arrived in Sydney, there was less endodontists than there are now. And basically, the number of specialists is growing all the time. And really, it's a matter of wanting, I think, doing specialist training. It's not, I spoke to a lot of people about this over the years, and it's not about kind of saying, oh, I want to like do endo all day and like have higher fees than other people. It's more about where you're going in your career and where you want to end up. It's not about these other things, because obviously by the time you take into account the competition for referrals, the setup, the cost of university and the time off work for the 3 years, it's not that beneficial. But if you end up where you want to end up, then it's well worth it. So with me, I had done my general dentistry. I enjoyed it, but I could see that I just really liked the idea of being able to, well, I'm talking to you on the podcast. So this is the sort of thing I really enjoy. Like, and I probably wouldn't get the opportunity if I was working in general practice. Mm-hmm. So this is the things that I really enjoy. And I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine. So my friend's an entertainer in his spare time. He's a magician, and he had done like a diploma of dentistry. And during the diploma, he realized that he wanted to specialize. He loved learning and teaching. And well, he's an entertainer in his spare time. So this lends itself to being a specialist and linking that kind of work into your dentistry, and that's always something I've enjoyed: teaching, socializing, interacting, and things like that. And it really lends itself to that in special. When you become a specialist, you become a teacher, you become a writer. You maybe help people with their issues with their career, maybe with their root canal treatment problems. It's not really something that you get as in general practice running a business. So basically, it's something that you can get as a specialist, and I really enjoy part of it.
That's a really fantastic perspective to have on that. Actually, is to you're saying that so you're specializing for a personal reason, and I guess letting the rest of it kind of sort itself out. There are more competition for referrals, but what you want to do is teach, and what you want to do is help people, and you can do that as a specialist. That's a great way to think about it, and I appreciate that. It's actually food for thought for myself, although I'm not going to specialize. Speaking of being I've already thought that through. I'm pretty sure about that. And a young family and doing another 3 years and all the rest of it, that's not going to happen. But so being a specialist, you're helping a lot of particularly, I would think, graduates and well, all dentists, of course. I want to get an idea of, as a specialist endodontist, what is the proportion of treatment you're doing that is, say, fixing a complication compared to, say, unaccessed teeth? How do you break up your day with that?
I would say that a lot of patients come with previously treated root canals, and it can be a challenge to try to correct these. But we do have to devote like an hour, probably, or an hour 15 minutes to try to do the consult, start the treatment, and just see if we can get it done. The biggest difficulty we have, obviously, is most of the time it's diagnosing cracked teeth and things like this. So we do have to access the tooth and explore the fractures. Like, we get these cases referred a lot in, which is fair enough, because they are complicated and they are a bit of a mystery. So we don't tend to break the day up into like consults and treatment and things like that. We pretty much just go with what we have. At the surgery, we try to see all our patients for treatment on the day that they come. I mean, no one wants to, there's not many people who want to come and have a chat about root canal treatment and then go. But there are patients who do, you know they've got apical disease, but they don't know what that means and it's asymptomatic, and they want to come to discuss whether it's worth treating and whether they need it and what will happen if they don't have it done and what happens if they do have it done. And we have to go through all that, and that takes half an hour to consult visit. And we do get patients who request this, but this is not as common as starting the treatment. And sometimes that hour long, and some of these don't end up starting the treatment for the hour because, you know, the patient gets gets the news back from us that perhaps the tooth is not really worth saving, or maybe it's going to involve some surgical procedure that they hadn't thought about, and they need to discuss this or think about this. And it's, sometimes it's nice just to have that hour and say, look, we're probably not going to start the treatment today because there's so much to think about, but then just give them a good experience and just say, look, if you want to go away, think about it and have a look at the treatment options, and then just come back to us if you feel like it. And then they come back with a sort of like more resolve to do the treatment rather than starting on the day. So sometimes it's worth doing that for some patients.
It's always a good point to give your patients some time to think about the more complex decisions, particularly when it's significant amounts of money, as is, say, retreatment and a crown for a tooth to save it. With complications, so you'd surely see complications often caused or iatrogenic from the dentist. Thinking particularly about new graduates, what do you most often see, and where do you think the problems arise for graduates?
With new graduates, there's a couple of areas of interest. Diagnosis was always one that I found difficult with endo, and interpreting what the test results mean and understanding the how accurate they are, and that's one issue. And the other issue is obviously we do get a certain number of fractured file cases. But look, I mean, we all have to have this learning process with these instruments, and sometimes they don't they fracture. But fortunately, since the UK introduced single patient use or single use files, I've been doing that since then. It's around about 2006. They started introducing that as a guideline because of the NHS and it being a government funded program or health program. They basically just said it's you're required to use the instruments once. And then as that happened, as time goes on, we've found less instrument fractures because of this. So in my practice, I have single patient use instruments. To avoid this is one of the things that, and obviously as you get more experience, you get the use of like how you can use them and why, and you just get an idea of how they, and I think it's more about how they're used. So some further training in instrumentation systems is pretty good for any new grads out there who want to do it, just to learn how to use these instruments and minimize the risks. But yeah, we honestly, I would say diagnosis is a very important thing, and it's not taught that much. It was taught very sparsely at dental schools, and it's really important. And I do actually do lectures on diagnosis, but you have to make them exciting. It's dead boring to talk about the different types of diagnosis of apical and pulp diagnoses and how you eventually decide on what one. But like, if you can relate it to say something like the way you treat the case, then that's more exciting for dentists. So I do a lecture on this sometimes.
That'd be interesting to see. Could you just speculate on in what ways are graduates misdiagnosing? For instance, are they unwilling to diagnose an irreversible pulpitis and therefore sending it to you when it's clearly irreversible? Or,
well, I'd just say I wouldn't say specifically that. I'd say probably things like knowing how the tests work, and for example, you know, when you put a do a CO2 cold test or a cotton pellet cold test with endofrost, if the pulp's calcified, or maybe the patient doesn't respond on any teeth because that's sort of just the way they are, then this is not necessarily a bad thing. You have to have more evidence than a pulp test to initiate root canal treatment, I would say. You have to have a bit more. But as you get experienced, you you actually have a mind map in your head, which I'm sure I must write down one day, of how these patients are. And within about 5 minutes of talking to the patient, quite often you can get an idea of whether it's root canal disease or not. I mean, not always, and you have to do the tests, of course, but you have a good, I'll get patients coming in telling me they've had this on-off pain for like a year and a half, and you just know it's not going to be root canal disease. I mean, root canal disease is something that happens, and then you get facial swellings and you get pain, and it's usually so painful that patients can't sleep, and even if it's not an apical periodontitis, it's a pulpitis, and that's, you know, they can't drink water, and they say that water from the tap is sending them through the roof and things like that. They have to warm up their water sometimes or cool down. Some people like the cold water, things like this. So if they're saying things like that, that brings them to the dentist quite quickly. It's not a year and a half of like niggles. It's actually a root canal disease. But actually, the other day I had an interesting patient that came in, and she had a story like this, and I said to her when I did the test, you know what you're doing? You're clenching on this tooth. It's got to be. You've got no apical disease. It's been going for years. It's got no apical lesion after all these years of problems you had. It's responsive to the cold testing, and I'll tell you what, you'll probably be clenching. She'd just moved to Sydney. She'd packed up the whole house and moved, and I said, and then she turned around to me. It's funny how patients do this. They turn around to you and give you the answer afterwards. Oh, you know, you're right, because when I went on holiday for 2 months or whatever it was, it got all better, and then it came back again, and I was like, okay, so they just confirmed the diagnosis. Could have told me that at the start.
That is a good one to keep in mind, though, the bruxism or clenching causing traumatic, symptoms. And we see that. I see that myself fairly often, actually.
Well, I was just going to say, a good attitude to have towards these cases is there's not many patients. I think there probably is no patients out there who have ever died from not having a root canal treatment for a couple of days to wait and see how it goes. So rather than opening up a tooth if you're suspicious or not quite sure, maybe just don't open up the tooth and just see how you go. Especially if there's obvious things like no lesion and things like this. There's no problem that you can see that's obvious. Maybe just sit back and think, well, if I didn't start today and say the patient came back tomorrow and had more pain, then we can have a look tomorrow. I mean, it's not going to get serious for their health if you just monitor for a little time.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. And you're not committing a patient down a $3,000+ treatment plan when, you know, maybe they might not need that. So it's such an important thing. Do you have any advice for, you're talking about file separations are more common. What do you think the most common cause for that is? Is it just too much apical pressure on a file?
Yeah, it's just the way that the files are used. I think that we have there's two ways that files can separate: cyclic fatigue, which is the use of the file and it pulls and gets pushed and compressed and all these things while it's doing the work, and that's greater on files of greater taper that are bigger. And then you've got the torsional failure, which is where the tip of the instrument binds in the canal and it breaks off, and that's quite often that's the smaller files because you're pushing them down the canal before you've really opened the canal up, and the tip binds and it just cracks off as the file rotates, but the tip's still stationary. So I would say that it's learning those. Well, first of all, the cyclic fatigue is decreased if you use new instruments. Obviously, I don't think I've ever separated new files from cyclic fatigue. But torsional failure is always a problem. And again, to get over that, there's these new reciprocating systems that stop the torsional failure. We're supposed to minimize it because they reciprocate backwards when they, instead of rotating around and the tip binding and breaking off, they reciprocate backwards or forwards, depending on the instrument. So in other words, they basically disengage before the full rotation is achieved. So this helps, but there's a learning process here.
Do you think there's something we should be using?
What, the reciprocating systems?
Yeah.
Well,
do you think that's something that, as a general rule, should be used by every dentist?
Well, look, I really like reciprocating systems because they are, well, I mean, when you think about it, so with these systems that are always created and get a buzz and people are interested in them, I'm quite fascinated with them. I try and look and say, what's the reason for the system? And if I had the system in my practice, if I was a general practitioner, what would it mean for me? And the answer really is, with something like a reciprocating system, which is a short number of instruments, you're basically saying that you're not really going to do every single root canal treatment with an MB2 in your practice. That's what you're doing, but then at the same time, you're referring out cases that are challenging, but also you are simplifying root canal treatment for yourself and your practice, and then you're decreasing the chances of instrument fracture as well. So you've got to realize, when you have a system, not just think what's the quickest system, but think what it's doing for your practice. Something like, for example, Wave One Gold, it's a simple system, but you will decrease the cases that you can use it on, but it's a great system for simple endo. And if that's where your practice is at, then that's great. Something like ProTaper Next, for example, is a bit more complicated, but will give you more cases if you really like doing different cases. So it's really where your practice is at with endo that should really dictate what system you have, not sort of what you think is exciting. And then, because a lot of people, I think, buy the system, think that's a really great system, and then think they can apply it to every tooth, and that's not true at all.
Yeah, you need a few different tools in your toolbox to be able to treat a range of cases. And yeah, that makes sense. If you're only doing simple, you can use a single, well, something that is more simple. That makes a lot of sense.
I think I have something like 6 systems in my practice. Might be 5.
Fair enough. I don't think I'll be able to get my boss to buy 5 extras. So speaking of, well, with endodontics, we obviously then want to restore the tooth properly so that we don't get failure. And a big part of endodontic failure is because of the inadequate restoration. We had someone on the Dental Head Start group ask just a fairly broad question, but wanting to know what your thoughts are around the choice for, say, an onlay versus a crown, and if there's any evidence, you know, either way, and what you're seeing failures with.
Well, that's a really good question. Basically, an onlay is probably what we should be doing if we have got the tooth, if we don't have to do a full crown. I mean, like, so if the tooth is fairly minimally restored, or if it has a finish line, which is the boxes aren't too close to the gingival margin, we can pretty much do onlays. There is evidence showing, for example, that in premolar teeth, obviously, that's the one that everyone talks about because we have lack of dentine and it's a chewing tooth, that if it's a DO restoration, this is of a study by Minocci that was done many years ago. He used to tell us, he was my tutor at Guy's Hospital at King's now. He used to say to me, and what I liked about him, he was a restorative-based endodontist, so he had a lot of restorative research. And he said he'd done the only randomized controlled trial, or one of the only randomized controlled trials on restoration of premolar teeth with a class 2 lesion. And they'd basically looked at teeth, I think it was 3 years. So it's not a huge amount of time, but they'd done crown preps on the teeth with a fiber post, and they'd also done just a DO composite with the fiber post in these premolar teeth. And they found that the survival there was no difference in the survival, because by the time you cut that much tooth structure away for a crown, you've really compromised the tooth. And if you've got a DO, yes, it might fracture, but it's a DO, not an MOD. So that there's, you know, you do have a bracing, one marginal ridge to brace any chance of fracture. The longevity was pretty much the same. So with regards to restoration of premolars, for example, just be minimalistic as possible. I tend to be a bit more with being in private practice, and we want to give our patients longevity, and I try to be a bit more proactive. And you know, most of the teeth that I would see would have MODs in the premolars. There's not that many just DOs, and they need a root canal treatment. But I do tend to say, you know, to my referring dentist, onlays are the way to go if you can. But obviously, if you can't, then crown. But minimal invasive dentistry or adhesive dentistry is definitely the way forward.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just the modern way to restore a tooth, and so cuspal coverage, but either or work. It's just onlays more conservative, would you say?
Yeah, that's right. So onlays more conservative, but you can't, if you've got a, like, if you've got the boxes really low, you can't really do an onlay because you've got to put the finish line too low on the buccal and lingual side. So this is what really depends. So if you have not much tooth structure, then a crown's all you can do. And if you have enough, then you can finish the crown. Finish the margins just below the contact area.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's good to think about. So I had another question, and this is actually from James. James and I started Dental Head Start. So James has a patient who came to him for root canal therapy, or came to him with a problem that needed root canal therapy, and has now specifically requested him to irrigate with hydrogen peroxide, which she actually brings with her to the appointment. What are your thoughts on that? Is that clinically acceptable at all? Is there any evidence for or against
it? Yeah, well, hydrogen peroxide has been used in some places for irrigation of root canals, but there is evidence to say that it's not as good at tissue dissolving as sodium hypochlorite, because it's sodium hypochlorite, the thing that makes that dissolves tissue is actually the chlorine. I think you might have watched my ADA web seminar where I did on the 30th of January. I said, chlorine is in a positive state within sodium hypochlorite, and it wants to react with everything. It's the guy at the party that has no friends. He wants to interact. It interacts with everything because it's in that chlorine positive state. Well, hydrogen peroxide doesn't have this, so it doesn't have that tissue dissolving capacity. It has a bit of this, but not as much as sodium hypochlorite, and therefore it's a weaker antibacterial agent. But it has been used. It has been used before. I mean, it's not like it's an unused thing.
Yeah. Okay. Does it have? He asked the question. Does it increase the risk of inflammatory resorption or anything like that, or is that not the case at all?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. Imagine the the kind of percentage he's been using is what, 3%, something like that.
Well, interestingly, the patient brings it with her in a little bottle, I'm not sure if he's actually aware.
I think the other thing we've got to be careful for is whether that's TGA approved as an irrigant.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So let's. I want to ask one more question. This is the question that all graduates think about quite a lot with endo. Is how do you find MB2? what tips do you have with people trying to find it? And do you think upper molars are treatable by graduates from the start in any situation?
Well, look, I'd say absolutely that graduates should definitely do endo. I'm not against them doing endo, but they should be mindful that they're in a situation where they're providing care for a patient and there are other people who can help them or can treat the case as well. I think this is something that's very different when you're working. It depends where you're working, and there's a few things in there about, whether the specialist is next door to you and things like this. Or if you're working with a two-hour, trip for the patient, they don't want to make the trip, and there's a few issues there. I get questions quite a lot about this. But actually, with regards to something like the MB2, it can be a huge challenge. I mean, I get cases. In fact, the other day I found MB3, and I was just like, wow, how could you have even found that? I found it after I'd been searching for quite some time and seeing on the radiograph that there's something unusual. And then, if you do a cone beam scan, you can see something. But this is something, the MB2, I think, is something that you can only find if you've got experience and the right tools. So if you're treating an upper molar tooth and you haven't got those tools or experience, you should really think about perhaps referring or finding someone who's more experienced to do the treatment, who has the tools and has the experience. If you find the MB2 and you can treat it, well, of course, that's fine. Like, go for it. Like, do the treatment if you think you can do it and you're confident. I don't want to put anyone off endodontics. After all, I was in the same situation as every new graduate when I graduated. And I, got there, got to specializing by doing all these cases. But you've got to be mindful of there are people around who can treat the cases and really, if it's not that inconvenient for the patient to go and they're happy to go, then that's another story. Yeah, getting back to your question of how I found MB2, well, If I give you an abridged version, I've got lots of my videos on finding MB2 on Instagram. I think there might be some in my lectures. In fact, I do hands-on courses where I show how I locate it, and there's a couple of good burrs I can recommend. Something like the comet burrs, the slow-speed comet burrs, the small ones, and the LN burr. I find them very good for just troughing. I like to trough with burrs, not use ultrasonics, because ultrasonic scratches the pulp floor and then you end up not being able to see if you scratched or whether that's the isthmus. And the other one I like is the XA.
And so what are you looking for?
When you use the burrs, you're looking to fill the isthmus or the canal with white dentine shavings. Just troughing gently, and as you see, you'll see the white line and white dot come up. And then, if you start to follow that white dot, what actually happens is you find that these canals actually start, but then they curve very much more mesially. So what you'll find is sometimes you're troughing down. This is why the microscope and magnification or illumination are so important. Sometimes you find the MB2. Orifice, and then by the time you get a millimeter down, it's now like another half a millimeter mesial than it was. And then when you've done that, you know you've beat the curves, because these all have, many of these cases, the MB2 has this coronal curvature, and that's why so many of us say, oh, there's the MB2, put a file in, and they can't get around the curve, it's just hitting a dead stop, because that is actually got this coronal curvature. And once you get past that coronal curvature, which is why if you look at some of my videos, and I've had some interesting comments about dentists saying, but if you've got the orifice and you can see it, why are you still drilling? It's because this has a curvature coronally, and you have to beat the curvature. You drill and then you go downwards, and then you've got around that curve. And when the file goes straight in, then it's going to go straight down. Got to be able to curve the file around at the coronally, and then that's when the instrument separation occurs, and that's when the instrument can't get around the curvature because it's already curving as it enters the canal. So this is a really important thing to know with regards to that root canal. But I was just about to say before, the XA ProTaper Next orifice opener is one of my favorite ones, just to open the orifice of the MB2. It just follows and you feel it bind, and then you just pull out and then go back to hand filing.
Yeah, that's a really interesting, actually. I didn't understand that, I'd never heard that before, how much it curves, particularly mesially at the start. And to be honest, I have had a case where I experienced that and did have to send it off. So thank you for sharing that. That's really, really helpful tip.
C-plus file is another one that's good. The C-plus file, if you gently use them without... The C-plus files, I really find, I used to not really be a fan of C-plus files because they got a cutting tip and I used to think, oh, it damages. But actually, if you use them like a probe and prod rather than actively try and go down the canal, you just prod away. Sometimes what happens is you prod, and then all of a sudden the file just kind of skips down past the curve, and then you can kind of push-pull action and you can kind of widen it, because they've got to... Like, for example, the size 6 C-plus file has a 5% taper in the first 3 millimeters, so it's like 6, 11, 16, 21 instead of the usual 2%, and you'll get this sort of arrowhead kind of like opening. So you get the tip small, but the opening is big, so that'll sometimes get you out of trouble, but I don't use them routinely, just for these kind of things.
So I'm making a little list now of the things I need to get to help me out in these situations. C-plus files I have experienced or used before, but I'd never recognized that concept of just using it as a pecking almost and not activating it so it doesn't transport.
Yep.
So that's a really good tip.
That's right. Yeah, that's a very good. And don't use above size 8 because it can get – the thicker they get, the more – easy that is to transport. So I tend to stick to 6 and sometimes 8, and 10's almost never, and I haven't ever used a 15, so there you go.
Yeah, that's a good point too. So you've got, imagine a graduate's got this case where they've found MB, DB and palatal on say a 1.6, instrumented those canals but cannot find MB2. What's the next step? Obviously we're thinking about referral. I want to get your ideas. What do you recommend? How do we manage that situation? Because often we've gone through a session of treatment and charge for it. but now we're sending them off. How do you recommend we deal with that?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I think, to be honest, with these sort of cases, the best thing to do is to try and minimize the fees to the patient if you're going to refer. Dress the canals or do something that's going to get the patient out of pain. You know, you need a diagnosis to be able to work out whether that's full extirpation or just being able to hook out the coronal pulp. The variety of, you know, depending on what the pulp status and apical status are. But just get the patient out of pain and then just refer them on, because the patients don't like to have a high fee and then to be told by the endodontist it's further more fees. And some dentists just charge for an extirpation or even give them something back or something like that, or do that for the patient if they've, you know, say they've done the first stage and then the endodontist needs to do some more work. Usually, as an endodontist, we don't. You know, we have to do all the work again, because if there is a problem, the patient's coming back to us.
Of course. Yeah, you're guaranteeing the work, so you have to have done it and know that you've done it right. So therefore, they're getting charged. Even if you've instrumented 3 out of 4 canals, they're getting charged for all 4.
Well, exactly. This is how it works. There's a few cases I do 1 canal for a dentist or whatever, but I've got to be pretty sure that everything is going in the right direction.
Be careful. You'll have a bunch of referrals asking for you to just do MB2.
Yeah, no, I don't just do that.
I can imagine. All right. Well, thanks for all those tips there on endo. And I think everyone knows that they can find a whole lot more on your Instagram and your Facebook. So with the Facebook group, the Instagram, what's the future? What are you planning with that? Are you kind of just keep going along as you are, or do you have any big things coming up?
We have social events now. We had a nice one just the Congress, we had a nice evening there with some talks from local endodontist Erica Vinsa. We had a few friends of mine talking about their clear aligners. We do things like this. So this is the future. I think the next thing I'd really like to get into is running courses for general dentists, looking at, say, a case where start to finish case or something like that. Get some a colleague of mine who works in the UK, and to be honest, the courses that you can do in the UK are incredible. They're so diverse. You can do 10-day endo courses. You can do 2 days. You can do so many different options. And I'm trying to get maybe some of his ideas and maybe bring them to Sydney so that we can teach these more comprehensive courses. I think the problem with a lot of courses are they're too much information, and then you've got ones that are very simplistic. But I think that somewhere in the middle, like especially for people who are new graduates, I mean, we just talked about some reciprocating systems, and look, to be honest, they're not really taught a lot at university. So because of, of course, the need to buy a reciprocating motor and the one that supports that system. But to be honest, we could do, you know, a small course on these systems or the ideas behind them and why, and just something simple for new graduates would be a really good course. So I'm trying at the moment to organize this. There's lots of, obviously, as you probably realize, I've got lots of things to do. So I probably won't get around to this year, but maybe next year. We do have other courses though this year, and they're about to be, the dates are about to be set for these, for the second half of this year. They'll be at the St. Leonard's Center for Dentistry, the Dents by Serona one in Sydney. And the other, there could be a possibility of me doing courses in Australia in the future around interstate. So this may happen this year, I'm not sure. Last year what happened was it all happened at the end of the year, and I did a whole lot of trips to Queensland and places like this. But at the middle of the year I didn't know they were going to happen. So it could happen this year, but we'll try and definitely get onto some new ideas next year for the courses with regards to Facebook page and where it's going. I want to organize some kind of videos to put on there that are going to be educational for dentists, like just the concepts behind the instruments we use, or the things that I use, why I use them, why I like them better or worse or whatever, or if there's something else is better or it's more preferable, should I say, than Then another thing I used to use, there's always, with all these things, there's disadvantages and advantages with every instrument. So it's not a matter of things being worse than something else. It's more normally in a certain situation, it's better because of this. In a certain situation, it's worse because of this. So it's not really good instruments versus bad. It's just more like what, how you use them and what you use them for. So this kind of concept could be quite useful for the Facebook page and the Instagram in the future. So I think this is the way it's going to go. I mean, things are very web-based nowadays, and I think this is just going to continue.
Yeah, I think I have no doubt about that. I think those resources sound really, really helpful for the general dentist in general, but also graduates and students. I learn a lot from you through my years when I was a student as well, and that was so helpful. So all the best with those courses that you're thinking about bringing out to Australia. I think that there's definitely a market for that kind of thing. And please do share it on the Dental Head Start community, the group and the page, when those things come about, because I think people would want to hear about it. You do have a course coming up, did you say, the 31st of May? There's a hands-on course. Is that at St. Leonard's Dent Supply?
Yeah, that's in the 31st of May at St. Leonard's, with myself, Jacqueline, and David Barnard. We're doing a course. It's a bit of a comprehensive, or what I would say, advanced course, using ProTape and X-Wave 1 Gold, and basically a bit of endo-resto. The ideas behind, you know, SDR and a few other, you know, post and core. When do you do a post? When don't you? And why? And, you know, adhesive dentistry and a few little ideas like that checked. And it's just one day. But it's going to be quite interesting, and it's sometimes nice to have a diverse group of lecturers, because I even learned some stuff off these guys.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Unfortunately, I'm in Port Macquarie, so not sure if I'll be able to make that, but I'll tell you what, I'd like to do that course one day. Sounds good. So, Omar, we started with saying thank you for all that you do for the dental community, particularly for graduates and students. And I want to finish with the same vein. So you have actually helped me a lot with my endodontics throughout the years, and I appreciate it. And I have no doubt there's literally thousands of others out there feeling the same way. So thank you for that. And thank you for sharing your time today with us on the podcast.
No problem, David. Thanks for inviting me. And it's a big honor to be able to speak to Dental Head Start today. And look forward to hearing from more from the new grads and everybody in the future.
Absolutely. If people want to reach out, they can find you at Specialist Endo Crow's Nest page. And then is it Specialist Endo on Instagram?
At Specialist Endo is on Instagram. Yes, that's right.
Perfect. All right. Well, I hope some people will reach out and say thanks for all that you do. For now, have a good night. Thank you. All right, that was Dr. Omar Ikram, specialist endodontist, a very generous person who really does want to help graduates and students succeed with their endodontics. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I've got a lot from it, and I'm sure you have too. Check out his page, his Facebook page at Specialist Endo Crow's Nest, his Instagram page at Specialist Endo. And if you're in Sydney, of course, he's there to help you as a specialist. And of course, keep an ear out for his hands-on courses that he's running. He does a lot of stuff with ProTaper and Dent Supply. And if you want to get more information on how to and to use these instruments, it's definitely worth going to one of his hands-on courses. We also had a chat with Omar last year. It was a blog format, so it was just written text on our website. But we got a bit of an idea about him then. And at the time, he actually shared some tips. His last tip, which was how to clean up the cavity after obturation, getting rid of that guttapercha, was so useful. It's as simple as using a slow speed round burr to remove or gently brush out that excess guttapercha. And it's quick, it's easy, it's something that's really saved me a lot of time. So check that post out on our website at dentalheadstart.com. If you like the podcast and the tips, please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or you can subscribe via email at our website. If you do, there's also a free metaphors infographic that can help you out with describing some things for your patients. If you want to get a heads up on the future interviews you're about to do, or just want to ask a question to a bunch of like-minded new graduates, then you can join our Dental Head Start Facebook group. It's specifically there so that you can get an idea of what's going on with the podcast and talk within as a community. So join that group and feel free to post questions or to inbox me, and I can post those questions anonymously if you like. And finally, the one thing I really would appreciate you do is to share this with a group of dental students or your fellow dentist friends and let them know what's going on with this podcast. Let them know if you think they'll enjoy this or get something from this and help us reach more people and help more people with this concept. So thanks for listening. I'm looking forward to the next episode.